you all for being so generous in your time and waiting for us to get done with the last meeting that got I hastily called for this room. We have many bills today, and I think you'll find that they're all very interesting. So we're going to get started right away with Senator Marty's bill. Welcome, Senator Marty. This is Senate File 859.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill is a very simple one. As many of you know, I think most of you are familiar with the fact that a whole lot of the people who populate our prisons and our jails are people who have mental illness issues that may have been the reason they are in the jail or the prison in the first place. And we do a very poor job at this time of addressing those needs before they get there, which is why they're there, while they're there, and after they get out. This bill is simply an attempt to provide some funding to try and help people on their way out, discharge planning, make sure we don't just take somebody out of a jail and dump them on the street with no help, and so where they're going to be in the same vulnerable spot they are, which is much more likely to lead them back where they were. And I have Sue Abderholden here is going to go through the bill very quickly. I'm happy to stand for questions before or after.
Okay, thank you, Senator Marty. Ms. Abderholden, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. My name is Sue Abderholden. I'm the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Basically, the bill would provide grants to counties who want to develop reentry projects for people coming out of their jails. Discharge planning would include assisting in reestablishing or establishing health care and disability benefits, getting all the kinds of, you know, informed consent that you need for treatment needs, referrals, arranging for basic needs such as food, housing, transportation, and employment, securing an appointment with a psychiatrist, or community mental health provider, or chemical dependency provider, a 14-day supply of medications, and a prescription that will be at least for a 30-day supply, arranging for a state photo identification card, and identifying if there was a case manager or if you need a referral to a case manager, making sure that people are hooked up. We would include an evaluation component of outcome measures so that we could really demonstrate the cost savings and reduced recidivism. And these appropriations would be for 2 years.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, we also have Tara Long. Who is going to testify briefly as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last name. If you would spell it when you start so I can get a sense of it.
Tara Long, L-O-N-G.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Long. Go right ahead.
Okay, my name is Tara Long. I'm from NAMI, Minnesota as well. As part of my position at NAMI, I travel around to county jails across the state and provide information and awareness about mental illness to correctional staff. They invite me to come in, and they would like the education. Last spring, NAMI developed a report of a survey conducted of Minnesota jails in December of 2005. And according to that survey, 60% of jail staff said that they frequently see mental illness inside their jails. And as I have visited across Minnesota, many of the jail administrators, the jail nurses, and program staff say they frequently see mental illness inside the jails as well. According to the survey, about 86% of jail staff said that the jail's current ability to address the needs of inmates with mental illness was limited. Jails are unable to address treatment needs or provide discharge planning for people with mental illness. Only about one place in the state is providing discharge planning, and they're doing that by collaborating and going above and beyond their jobs without any funding to kind of meet the need in their county. According to the Department of Justice report that was released last September, about a quarter of jail inmates with a mental health problem had three or more prior incarcerations. High recidivism rates for this population are evidence of the need of discharge planning in our jails. Persons with mental illness who are released from jail without discharge planning are most likely to have a successful return to the community. Discharge planning helps to save money, helps to break the cycle of recidivism, and keep the persons with mental illness in the community connected with proper services and support. And it's less expensive to provide mental illness treatment in the communities than in our correctional facilities. When people are incarcerated, their benefits, their SSI, their SSDI, their MA are terminated. This often means upon release, when they walk out the door of the jail, they don't have access to their health care or their financial support. And sometimes they don't leave with any medications. They have no benefits to cover the cost of their medications and treatment, which federal law allows for suspension of benefits for an inmate if they are incarcerated for 30 days or more. In Minnesota, benefits are terminated and the person needs to reapply. And this can be a very daunting process for a person with serious mental illness. So when a person leaves the jail, they may not be doing well. They may have gone into the jail in a crisis, and they may leave in a crisis. Sometimes they are told, you know, go to social services, fill out an application, and reinstate their benefits. Many jails report that social services will not go into the jails and help persons with serious mental illness fill out an application. So sometimes it's a nurse that's trying to get an application and help them fill it out. Someone with a serious mental illness first needs to be able to get to social services, when they leave the jail, and then they need to fill out an application and supply documents. So just kind of as an example, for those of you who don't know, the application is about 36 pages long for the people to fill out and can be really overwhelming for someone who has a serious mental illness leaving the jail. They first would have to find the place, so they may not have a car, may need to get a bus token or a ride. They would have to organize some documents before they get there. They have to find proof of citizenship, pay stubs, bank statements, and titles. In the process, there's also questions about medical bills. They need to get their bills and kind of list out providers, where, when, dates, and stuff. And they also would need to list, assets, whether they have bank accounts, contract for deed, different things that they owned, questions about who may live in their household, what's going on, a lot of questions and a lot of documentation that probably they aren't able to gather. And then the problem is if the application isn't completely filled out correctly, they just accept the application, and then later they may be informed a couple weeks later that it wasn't filled out right and they still need to gather it. And some of these people, of course, do not have phones or places of residence. A relationship does exist between benefit restoration and lowered recidivism rates of released inmates with mental illness. A person with serious mental illness released into the community without discharge planning, which is the whole package, benefits, restoration, medications, case manager housing, employment, photo ID, or a way to get to social services or get medications is most likely to return to jail. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Law.
And Madam Chair, Brad Cater from Hennepin County, who's going to briefly comment. But before that, I want to say this is part of a bigger picture. I mean, we're also trying to make sure right now when you go into jail, you lose your medical coverage. And again, so you get out, and without this and that legislation, some of the people who are very seriously and persistently mentally ill and don't have their medication, you know there's going to be a problem when we put somebody on the street without their medication. So this is one of a couple of bills that are trying to address parts of that. Mr. Cater is with Hennepin County.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cater.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brad Cater. I'm with the Hennepin County Criminal Justice Committee. I'm the coordinator for that committee. I also coordinate the Hennepin County Pilot Discharge Planning Project for residents with mental health issues at the Adult Corrections Facility in Plymouth in Hennepin County. I'm here to offer support for this bill, which would provide grants for county discharge planning. From my perspective, as someone who has been in criminal justice for 20 years, there's been an increased focus recently since 2000 on discharge planning or reentry services. This has come from a number of fronts. It's come through housing advocates, the Massachusetts Housing and Shelter Alliance, which began linking shelter populations with persons who were released from jail or prison. It comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which requires states and local general government to develop discharge policies as a requirement to receive funding. We're seeing it up at the state level at the Minnesota DOC, which has a number of transitional programs, including a program whose focus is release planning for persons with mental illness. We're also seeing a focus on employment. The National Institute of Corrections is sponsoring, in fact, in March, a Road to Reentry conference, and their premise is having a meaningful job with a livable wage. All of these programs approach discharge planning or reentry from different angles, but all recognize its importance. All of these efforts, whether they put housing or medical care or employment or income support at the top of the list, all these programs recognize that there needs to be a holistic approach to reentry for the different offenders that are entering the community again. For the most part, within the local facilities and our workhouses and even to some extent, the state facilities, the folks we deal with are charged with livability offenses, drug and property crimes. When I did a match between shelter data and our criminal justice data, we did find a small number who had violent offenses, but that was only about 18% of the total match. Current research recognizes that that these small percentage of frequent users of criminal justice and social service systems. In 2005, our office sponsored a look at downtown livability crimes, and we came up with the Downtown 33, or many of you might have read the New York Times article on Million Dollar Murray. These are folks we want to target, a chronic population that's moving in and out between social service and criminal justice systems. Those are the folks where we could potentially get the most return if we can reduce recidivism and cut into the $100 a night or $70 a night jail stays. We're testing the return on investment now for providing discharge planning to persons with mental illness. This Senate bill does an even better job because it is a broader approach to targeting this population. They're looking at not only persons with mental illness, they're also looking at folks with TBI, chemical dependency, and the homeless. It also allows applicants to design programs for their own community. I grew up in Benton County, and I would imagine that the needs in the jail in Foley and the programs available would be very different than what I'm working with in Plymouth, Minnesota. And that's why we're offering support for this bill, because it provides funding to test reentry ideas, and these ideas might potentially provide system-wide cost savings.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty, I have a note from a person in the audience who would like to testify on your bill to Michael Undlin. You'd come on up to the table. We'd like to hear your story.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
If you say your name for the tape, please.
Sure. Michael Undlin.
Great. Thank you.
And other interested parties. I speak from having direct experience with jail intake procedures, including medical screening, which included mental health screening, and how quickly things can go awry if it's not done well or right or better. And on behalf of others who may find themselves in a similar situation, I'm hoping I can at least take that experience and help support bills like these and maybe provide a little bit of language for consideration that might tighten up a couple of gaps. To give an example of that, one of the concerns I have is that the language suggests that the and this is true in related bills or companion bills, that the tool be developed sort of like by the Commissioner of Corrections with the consultation of the Commissioner of Human Services. I would suggest language that makes that a joint agreement, as opposed to giving the Commissioner of Corrections veto power over the Commissioner of Human Services ideas, which may be a little bit more protective of those suffering from mental illness than from the corrections perspective, from what I've seen. Another thing that I saw is that the screening tool can fall apart pretty quickly if the people who are using it are either not well trained or not well supervised or held accountable or are not sensitive to the fact that somebody might be in a decompensated state with respect to mental illness while in intake, which was my situation. I was I had a hospital gown on. I was barefoot. I was non-responsive. I had a bracelet on. And through the jail intake, my non-responsiveness was essentially deemed that, you know, I was okay coming in as a fairly regular intake, as opposed to having called the nurse to do a more thorough mental health evaluation. In other words, they skipped it, in spite of a fair amount of evidence that, you know, maybe something wasn't quite right here. So one of the things that I suggest is that a non-response be coded as positive for mental illness screening, as opposed to allowing the jail personnel to code that as not a problem, which is what I think in part happened. Another area that strikes me as important from an intake perspective is that the notification of professionals, if there's a mental health issue that is discovered, that in addition to notifying professionals and things of that nature, it strikes me that there should be some notification to family. If my wife had received a call and made aware of the situation that I was in, that they were kept in the dark about for 36 hours, it may have saved me from having gone through the horrible experience. So I just suggest that if there's some language to consider relative to informing family and to contacting or identifying whether somebody may have just come out of a hospital, which I did. That was referenced, but the fact that it came off of a locked mental health unit was not conveyed to 911 from the hospital. It wasn't conveyed to the police officer. The police officer didn't check on it, and he didn't tell anything about it to the jail people, to the best of my knowledge, according to all the paperwork I've received or reviewed. So I just make those suggestions to tighten up where mistakes might be made so that people can get caught earlier and earlier and earlier.
Well, thank you very much for giving us those suggestions.
One final thought.
One final thing? Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll remember to say it right this time. Madam Chair, one final thought is that with respect to discharge planning, in the situation that I was in, they knew that I came, they finally knew because I told them that I came out of a mental health unit. I endured a fairly painful experience for a number of hours. I was in the throes of trying to recover from that experience through the night, through the next day. They all knew that whatever shape I was in had been made worse by the activity that happened there. And with respect to discharge planning, which is part of the policy and procedures within the Hennepin County jail system, as well as the procedures that I've described associated with intake, they didn't do a thing. They didn't care. They just let me walk right out the door. So I just want you to know that there's got to be some additional checks and balances. Thank you for your time. I much appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I would strongly encourage the committee to look at some funding for these grants. I think it would be a big help. And I know the bill also has, there's some parts of this that would not be under the jurisdiction of your committee as well, and I don't know whether you want to take your language aside for consideration, your bill, and then pass the rest of the bill on to perhaps Senator Foley's division and Senator Berglund's, or?
Just a minute.
I didn't hear.
And then we'll just keep what we have. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, did you talk, and I'm sorry, I apologize, I stepped out for a minute. Did you talk about how the county jails would be able to apply for this type of funding, what kind of a process that would be?
Madam Chair, Senator, it would be kind of like a grant proposal, an RFP would be put out, and then the counties could then apply for it. And they would just have to show that there was collaboration on the local level and lay out how they would, you know, kind of address some of the requirements. And in some situations, they may just need one person, you know, hiring one person on staff to conduct discharge planning. In larger counties, it might be two or more. So we wouldn't be limiting or, you know, stating how much money per project.
Senator Ingres?
Just a follow-up, please. Could you explain the collaboration again? Again, I'm sorry, I probably stepped out when that was going on.
No, Madam Chair, Senator, need to have the county jails collaborating with human services and social services on the local level because they have to work together in order to have good discharge planning.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, I had at one time when the Department of Corrections
was making a presentation of their overview of the governor's budget requests, had asked if they ever had done any tracking of the people in their facilities that have received discharge planning for serious and persistent mental illness to try to ascertain what the reoffense rate is, if it's less than it was before we started doing that. And I don't know if they ever were able to track that down or not. I never saw it, so I think it might be a good time to hear about that if we have that information.
Let's see what we can find out.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And I thought we had sent that to Senator Berglund, so I apologize for that, and we'll get something to you in writing. I can tell you we did a preliminary study back in August of 2006, and it was a very small handful of offenders that we did. But we found out that offenders released with release planning, that 63% of them had no events or no occurrences of reoffense during their supervised release. In 2002, there was a similar sample done. Again, it was a very small handful of people, and we found that 39%, only 39% had no events during their supervised release. So I think that gives us some good indication of how effective discharge planning does help.
And, Madam Chair, just one other comment then. This money has flowed through the Department of Human Services, but these people actually are employees, if you want to call them that, because they are supervised through the Department of Corrections. And we did that because we hoped, and I believe we do get a little bit of federal matching monies on this, because most people with serious and persistent mental illness need to have a plan once they're in the community. And so the counties don't have to do a plan then for these individuals. It's already done. It is a bit of a strange thing to have people paid for out of one budget that actually work in facilities that are not in that department's purview. So probably sometime in the future we might want to look at getting that transferred over to the Department of Corrections, that base budget.
Let's see. Senator Ma, I think you had your hand up.
I did. Madam Chair, I just wanted to know that with the 63%, how many actual people does that entail?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair and Senator Moi, it's only 33 offenders.
Madam Chair, 33 Senator offenders Moi. Were tracked, and it's 63% of the 33?
Madam Chair and Senator Moi, no, there was a total of 52 offenders who were tracked. 33 of them had no events during their supervised release. 14 of them, or 27%, returned to prison as an RV. And then 10% of them returned to prison with a new conviction. As I said, it was a very small handful. It was a very preliminary study, but something that we were able to do.
And, Madam Chair, how long was the study?
The study was done in August of 2006. And they were released from prison between February 1st of 2005 and September 30th of 2005. So 9 months.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
And Madam Chair, the reason that I've wanted to get this information is because I've always believed that this type of discharge planning does save money in the end, because it does reduce the recidivism rate. And so maybe hopefully, I don't know, Ms. Schrader, if you feel like you got enough discharge planners now. We got you two more last session for beginning this biennium. And I just know that, as I recall, you had a need for more.
Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I think last year you had asked us for some information regarding our need for discharge planners. We currently have enough discharge planners in our facilities to provide provide services for those who are truly SPMI. That doesn't mean that we're really working on those with severe mental illnesses or those who could not use it. I think the information that we provided to you last year was that we would need about 7 discharge planners total in our system, and we currently have 3.25.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund,
and Ms. Larson, have you ever been able to get this cost built into the per diem so that as the numbers of inmates increase, you could have some hope of keeping up with the need as opposed to just having it done on a straight appropriations basis?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I don't believe we have done that analysis, but I'd like to check and talk with our folks who deal with the marginal per diem. I know we have mental health services built into that marginal per diem. I don't know if they include the release planners.
Madam Chair, that's just another recommendation that I would have in this area, because otherwise people like Senator Marty just have to come with his hat in his hand every once in a while hoping somehow we can scrape together the money for some more positions. And it seems to me that it's been in effect long enough now to prove itself as a worthwhile, cost-effective service of the Department of Corrections. And so just like they don't have to come with their hat in their hand, you know, to fund an education program or a GED program within the correction system, they shouldn't have to come with their hat in their hand to get additional discharge planners for people with serious and persistent mental illness. It just seems to me like, you know, it's something that can so easily fall between the cracks. And, you know, unless you have a governor that really has a personal interest in this area, he's going to think once he funded the per diem that he's done what he needed to do to take care of the needs.
Senator Berglund, the longer I'm in this committee, the more complicated I find this all. And that's just one more piece of it that you're right. It isn't just a per diem, and it's, you know, not food and a bed and all that. It's all the other stuff that goes along with it that we need to keep an eye on. You're right. Further questions for Senator Marty and the witnesses? Members, the Senate Council says that what we should do, since this has to, Section 2, Subdivision 2 goes to Human Services funding and Subdivision 3 goes to the Judiciary Finance Committee, that what we should do is delete pages 1, 2, and 3 up to and including 3.22. And hold that piece here in our committee, then we will send the last two subdivisions back to finance, and then it will either go to Senator Foley's division and then to Senator Berglund's, or Senator Berglund's and then Senator Foley's. Mr. Backus, did I get that right?
Madam Chair, essentially, yes. I mean, we would want to keep on line 3.19, the new section and the appropriations and renumber, of course, but that's the substance of what we'll do exactly.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I would make that motion for Senator Marty.
Okay. Any more discussion on that? Senator Foley.
Just briefly, I note on the, I didn't think we cut this out, but in line 3.4 on page 3, there's some language in there dealing with the state photo identification card, and there's nothing in there that I can see that would update that when the prisoner moved from one place to another. And so I'm not sure why they have that ID card in there, but if they do that and use that and require it, it should, in my mind, be updated periodically, or the individual, be kind of like a driver license. You have to renew it when you move.
I assume that's what you have to do. It would expire, I'm sure, like a driver's license. So, okay, on Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Then the next motion is to send the bill back to finance. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 859 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred back to finance. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you,
Madam
all
Chair,
very
members
much.
Of the
Senator Moy.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 1159. Senate File 1159 wants to create a pilot project. And so I'm going to walk through what that is, and then I have some people here who would like to testify on the bill. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1159 asks for an appropriation from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety that will be a pilot project grant to the City of St. Paul to implement an integrated domestic violence response framework. And the project will focus on developing policies, procedures, and quality assurance for domestic violence responses from 911 operators, law enforcement, prosecutors, probation, district court, victim advocates, social service providers, and other identified interveners. Second, the project will develop an informational gathering dissemination plan for interveners. And then thirdly, it will develop training curricula for the interveners. We're also asking that the project will develop a statewide model for a domestic violence response framework that may be used by local criminal justice agencies and advocacy programs throughout the state. The City of St. Paul may contract with outside organizations, but that contract shall be subject to the city's municipal bidding procedures through the city's RFP process. Madam Chair and members, this request is a one-time appropriation and will be available for the biennium ending on June 30th, 2009. We're also putting in a reporting requirement that the City of St. Paul report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate and House committees having jurisdiction over criminal justice funding and policy on the results of the project. I'm so pleased to share this proposal with you because the aim is to enhance government agencies' response to domestic violence cases and develop a best practices approach to coordinating our efforts. Although the appropriation may be to St. Paul, the ultimate benefit, I believe, is statewide once we can successfully develop a coordinated framework for domestic abuse cases as a pilot project in St. Paul. When a domestic abuse situation occurs, the system's response might begin with a 911 call, then police intervention, social services, prosecution, courts, probation, and many other actors are involved in this process. With all of these agencies playing an important part, we have a great system for domestic abuse victims in Minnesota. However, we can do better. By better coordinating our efforts between agencies, and we can learn from each other on a statewide basis. This one-time appropriation will allow government agencies in St. Paul to develop coordinated policies, procedures, and quality measures for all aspects of domestic violence cases from the original 911 call to case disposition. The effort will further develop a framework to be used by local criminal justice agencies and advocacy programs throughout Minnesota. And the City of St. Paul was very fortunate to receive a federal arrest grant allowing for a thorough evaluation of how city and county organizations respond to domestic violence cases. The early stages of this federally funded study have already shown the critical need to build a response system to domestic violence cases that is based on a consistent philosophy and course of action, not the individual ideas and actions of each agency that touches these cases. With us today is Chief John Harrington of the St. Paul Police Department, Shelley Klein Johnson, who is the Executive Director of the St. Paul Intervention Project, and of course, Mary Kleiss, who is the retired Ramsey County District Court Judge and Chair of the ISAIAS Domestic Violence Task Force.
Welcome to you all. Welcome back, Chief. Would you turn that laptop over so we can... Terrific. Thank you.
No problem.
Are you going to start with the testimony?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for welcoming me back again. I'm getting to feel like it's old home here. I'm here to testify in support of the St. Paul Integrated Domestic Violence Response Framework. I want you to understand that this framework is based on a collaborative partnership, and my experience of 30 years of being a cop and working as the chief of police in the city tells me that when community partners work together, that is our best chance for long-term successful intervention in all kinds of crime, and this crime is very particularly one where successful collaborations are important. Our partnership includes already the St. Paul Police Department, St. Paul Intervention, Ramsey County Courts, St. Paul City Attorney's Office, and a host of other community organizations that have been part of our partnership up to this point. But more than that, I want to highlight why I'm passionate about this bill. When I took over as chief of police, I was really, quite literally, horrified to find out that in my city, there were 15,000 cases of domestic violence committed in the city of St. Paul. That's not the region, that's not the county, that's not the state, that's just within little old St. Paul. To put that in context, that's 350 cases a week. That's 40 to 50 cases a day. But I'm not really talking about cases, because what I'm really talking about is that's two women every hour, every day being battered. We're not talking about cases here. I think if we get really lost sometimes thinking about these as files that sit on somebody's desk. These are real people with real lives that are shattered every day by domestic violence. It is the equivalent of about $560,000 in police services. It's eight full-time cops doing nothing but just responding to domestic violence all the time is the equivalent of what it takes just to police the domestic violence calls in St. Paul. And I was just shocked that we weren't doing anything to make that go down. We talk about lots of other crime prevention efforts, but we really had not seen any significant efforts to make this go down until this intervention project came online. It was, I think, the most successful intervention that I've seen. I want to once again highlight that more than robberies, murders, rapes, ag assaults, if you add all of those together, you still don't get to about a third of the domestic violence rate we have in St. Paul. This framework comes out of a group of people that have success already. We have already done the initial audit of domestic violence work, and we have learned so very, very much already. From my department, just starting with the 911 operators, we've learned that our operators were not asking about either the history of violence or weapons before call, before they were sending the squads out to take these calls. And so from my perspective, it meant that we were not accurately assessing the lethality for the victims, and we weren't accurately addressing the lethality for my cops. Quite literally, we sent a cop, one quad over for a domestic over on Jinx Avenue. They rolled up. It was among domestic, actually. Two Anglo cops roll up there. The woman comes running out screaming at them in Hmong. They don't speak any Hmong. I was fortunate because Officer Nia Kong showed up, and what he heard from the woman's voice was gun. My cops went to a tactical approach rather than our normal crisis intervention, let's figure out what's wrong approach. And as they approached the house, they saw a man standing behind the doorway with a loaded gun. He saw the cops approaching, ran in the back, and he killed himself. It's a tragedy. But when we talk to the kids, and there were six kids in the house, when we talk to the kids, when we talk to the wife afterwards, what we know is his plan was to kill his wife and to kill his children and then kill himself. There were 46 women who died because of domestic violence in the last 2 years. 16 children have died in the last 2 years because of domestic violence. This is an outrage that we have to do something about, and we are in a position to do something about it. St. Paul is the model. We have learned a great deal from the audit already, but there is much more to learn. And just as we learned in the case with Duluth, when Duluth first piloted using arrest as a medium for dealing with domestic violence rather than to continue advising as we historically had, our model in St. Paul will have statewide implications. And if you think about that 15,000 number spread out over every city and every suburb and every township all over the state of Minnesota. It means lives saved. It means cops that will be safer. It means families that will be intact. I think we really very much need to pass this model and then be able to teach what we learn here in St. Paul.
Thank you, Chief. Judge Class, nice to see you again.
Thank you. Shelley's going to go next.
Hi,
I want to thank the committee for inviting us here today. My name is Shelley Johnson Klein, spelled with a C, and I'm the director of the St. Paul Intervention Project. And again, thank you.
You're welcome.
An integrated domestic violence response framework will enable grassroots batterwomen's programs and professionals within the criminal justice system the opportunity to reflect upon how we respond to domestic violence, what we need to change in our practices, and how to build upon what we are doing extremely well. The creation of this framework will result in better practices by which our entire state responds to domestic assaults, instilling a greater trust and understanding among multiple and diverse partners involved in responding to domestic violence, and generating new collaborative ideas and approaches to ending the violence in our homes and communities. It is our intent in the creation of this framework to ensure the voices and needs of the victims, particularly those with increased barriers to accessing help, are integrated into each facet of this project. To date, we are not only have the support of the Battered Women's Program, statewide agencies, and organizations that focus on the needs of diverse communities in pursuing this critical project, but we have their commitment to participate in its creation as well. Our state has been a national leader in addressing domestic violence, and domestic violence programs who have been working on this critical issue for over 30 years truly believe the creation of an integrated domestic violence response framework will take us to the next level in ending domestic abuse. It's our hope that you'll join us in supporting this critical project. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Louise Kloss. I am a retired Ramsey County District Court judge. I'm chair of ISAIAH's Domestic Violence Task Force, and I've been a member of the Supreme Court Gender Fairness Implementation Committee since it was created in 1988. Which is why I have some gray hair and have been around this table or have sat at this table before. And I was, I'm not going to say very much. I'll answer any questions that I can. And I'm very familiar with the audit, and I'm delighted by the response of the systems people in St. Paul, the agency member teams who went out and looked at everything that the criminal justice did in response to domestic violence from 911 on. And they are so enthusiastic, and their agency heads, like Chief Harrington and John Choi and the sheriff and others, were so delighted and also excited. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. But I wanted to say that when Chief Harrington said that he was horrified by 15,000 DV cases in St. Paul, I must say that about 20 years before he was horrified, I also had the same experience. Before I was appointed a judge in 86, I was a big family law expert. I was chair of the family law section of the state bar. I was chair of Minnesota's chapter of Minnesota of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and I gave lectures around on family law, etc. When I was appointed in 86, the chief judge wanted me to go on family law right away, but I held off till 88. And then we split our job, the two family court judges, and I reviewed 100 to 110 petitions for orders for protection every month. I was blown away by the nature and extent of domestic violence in little old Ramsey County where I lived all my life. And I was horrified as well, and it's been a passion of mine since then to see that at least in little old St. Paul where I live, that the criminal justice system responds appropriately all through the many interventions and interveners that come to play when someone calls 911. So thank you, and I'll answer anything I can.
Thank you. Questions for the group? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. question for any one of, I guess, the panel. To be clear in my mind, is this a project that would help respond to domestic abuse or help actually stop domestic abuse? I mean, what's your...
Well, my short answer Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
That's okay. So I just say it so that if somebody listens to the tape somewhere along the line, they'll know who's speaking. So
I see.
Don't let me interrupt you. I'm just kind of saying.
All right, Mary Lou Kloss. My short answer is that an effective response will prevent it. Number one, Chief Harrington's police will not have to go back time after time because the response was not effective the first time, because the system did not bring all the resources that it can bring to bear the first time to see that there isn't a second time. And the children who witness violence are affected greatly. And if we can intervene appropriately and diminish the 15,000 calls, we will be allowing our future citizens to learn in school, to develop to their full potential, and become the good citizens we want to have.
Madam Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that for me, this pilot project responds on two levels. One is to put in place the coordinated total systems response to an issue. What that helps is to make sure that the way we address domestic violence cases is effective from a number of different levels, from the revolving door issue, that when a case does come in, that it does get managed from the 911 call all the way through the courts. And ultimately, for me, what's important about this is that it communicates and sends a message to others out there who are involved in a domestic situation who don't have the courage or the confidence in the system to truly help them. We want to send a message that we're serious about creating a coordinated system where if you have the courage and you come forward, it will work for you. Not all the time, but we want to go towards a direction to create some confidence and comfort that if you do come forward, there will be some coordinated effort to make sure that you're safe and that we do address, you know, the situation. So for me, that's the best outcome that we can create, is to put a system in place where we will allow more people to come forward.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Follow. Understand that you are preaching to the choir when you talk to me about domestic violence. I've been to many of them myself, and I understand the importance of doing it properly and doing it right and getting those agencies to work together. That seems to be the real key, and I think that might stop the revolving door we're talking about. So, but I definitely know that that is an issue and it is a problem. Thanks.
Well, today at the Capitol, one of the many groups that's visiting today is one of the organizations working with folks involved in domestic violence, and it's a particularly fitting to have this bill up today. So. Thank you very much. Senator Bois, do you have a motion for us?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I should ask, is there anybody else in the audience who wants to speak on this bill? Okay, Senator Bois.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1159 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible consideration for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
You say that way better than I do. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pretty good. Where'd Ron?
Come on.
He's just out there.
Is he out there?
He is.
Okay.
Thank you. See you, John. That's not the thing that Stuart told me. So it's not school.
Oh, okay.
Oh, the ADR.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, the next bill up is Senate File 619, and I think you'll find this a very interesting bill. We have people here from the Midwest Challenge Program, and then Hillary Freeman, who works in reentry work at Hennepin County Workhouse, is here to talk to us as well. Who's going to start? Okay, go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting us in committee, and we appreciate being here, and also appreciate you carrying forward this very, very important bill.
Sir, why don't you state your name for the record so we know who it is that's speaking.
I am Ray Cole, and I'm the Executive Director of Midwest Challenge, and I also like to recognize in attendance I have a member from the community, Cheryl Cabot, who is the Executive Director of the Central Neighborhood Weed and Seed, and one of my staff members, Luann Kelly, who is Vice President of Administration. And the two of them have been instrumental in putting together the reentry panel that is a part of this program. And I think each of you have a packet of information about the bill and our work that we're proposing. Midwest Challenge has been working with those struggling with addictions and recovery since 1972. And in 2001, we entered the offender reentry world by starting a work release program. And I want to share with you experience that I had early on in this process that really changed my whole perspective on reentry. I felt I had a pretty good understanding after working so many years in the area of recovery and addictions. Early on, I brought all our guys together, all 24 of them, in a room, and I challenged them. I said, statistics tell us that over 70% of you will be back in jail within 3 years. What are you going to do to make sure you're one of the 30% that does not? And I was totally shocked. It was dead silence. There was no arguing. There was no challenging. Almost agreement. And afterwards, one of the guys pulled me aside and said, Ray, do you really think any of us can change? This is what we've been doing all our lives. This is what we know. This is all we know. And that changed my perspective because what I heard was hopelessness. I can't change. This is who I am. This is all I've done. And so from that point on, all of our programming had to have a piece in it to provide hope. You can change. You can be different. This is an opportunity to start a new life. And we share that over and over. And we've been very successful. You'll see in 2005 in your forms that it was recidivism rate was 28%. Of all those that graduated from our program, only 28% have gone back to prison. The downside of that is only 56% of our offenders actually that started our program actually graduated. And that's where we feel this is really important. If I look back over the 6 years, I could name on one hand how many offenders went back because they didn't get a job. But it's countless numbers who end up going back because they messed up because of the day after day after day rejection they've received, the anger that builds up to that, the frustration, and the bitterness. And what this bill will do is provide an individual, a reentry specialist, that will walk with them side by side. Yeah, through that process, the ups and downs not only help them in finding jobs and making connections with employers, but like I said, be an advocate to walk through that process. And not just as an individual, but they're going to connect, be the connection to that reentry panel, which will consist of other experts in the field of employment and housing and community connections and legal issues. And so it puts together a group of people, a community that will walk beside and work together to help this person. We believe this bill will serve to not only raise our graduation rate, but also lower the recidivism rate, save thousands of taxpayer dollars, but most important, it's going to save lives. Now, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, I would like to respectfully ask that you recognize Mr. John Mose, who is a recent graduate of our work release program and would like the opportunity to share his thoughts and some of his experiences with you.
Mr. Mose, welcome.
Thank you. For record, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having me speak here. For the record, my name is John Mose, and I'm a recent graduate of Midwest Challenge, and my length of my incarceration was 44 months. I'd like to talk a little bit today about some of the obstacles of work release, of gaining employment, and a successful reentry of a work release program. And one of my biggest obstacles was the background check that employers do. Most of them require a 7 to 10 years on your conviction rate. My conviction rate was 3 years, 8 months. And Ray was talking about the hope I'd come back day after interviews. And the big letdowns would know, you know, because of the conviction rate so high. It was very hard. And another one of the big obstacles was that DLC requires a starting wage of $8 or higher and a 40-hour week. And there's a lot of part-time jobs that they don't do a lot of background checks on that they're willing to hire a felon. If you could start in and jump in on a part-time job, that you can continue on looking for a 40-hour-a-week job after that. And they do a lot of, another obstacle is credit checks. A lot of us felons don't have no credit history when we come out. And there's no incentive for employers out there to hire any felons, and it makes it real hard. And medical insurance is another big obstacle. You can get the medical insurance, but it only lasts for 6 months through general assistance. And then to find a job, it's difficult to find a job that has medical insurance. I had to humble myself and take a job for $7.50 an hour. And my medical insurance will run out soon, and I don't have any through that employment. But that's another obstacle for finding employment. And I wanted to talk a little bit about housing, too. Another major obstacle in finding housing is another thing is background checks. You have a felony, it's real hard to get the housing. And you end up right back in a drug neighborhood. Even if you have no violent crimes, I have no violent crimes, and it's real hard to get that. And what I want to talk about, too, is having someone at the work release program that has a little, what do you say, CD training or whatever, because there ain't much out there. You got your AA and NA, and my case happened to be a meth case, and there's really nothing out. I talked to my PO yesterday. There's two meth programs in the Twin Cities that are directly on meth, and it's very hard to get any help with that. I've been clean 3 years, 8 months now, and all I've been able to do is attend AA, NA. And we need for a specific program that can teach on meth alone. It would also be helpful to have a staff member or an individual on hand with some CD training at one of the work release programs. And talk a little about Midwest Challenge. What worked with this program is that they keep you accountable, and they talk to you. They keep you accountable on several ways. First, by making you keep a daily planner. You're out. You make your plan where you're going to be applying for work, what time you'll be there. You call when you get to that appointed place. You call when you're done applying. And let's see. Secondly, they require you to call in. Okay, I have that. Sorry about that. To keep you accountable when you respect one another and use common courtesy, they keep you accountable by being a faith-based program. That also helped me very much. It also taught me how to act like a man should act and present himself at all times. Lastly, they encouraged and motivated me to go out every day and find work. If you come back from an interview and didn't get a job, they encourage you to keep looking, because by getting that first interview, you know people are out there interested in you. They encourage you through faith in God and that He does have a plan for me, that my job will come, not to give up, and that I'm a good person and things will happen for me. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moss. Appreciate your testimony today.
Sir Chair and committee members, my name is Hillary Freeman. I'm a crime prevention specialist with the Minneapolis Police Department, working on a program with the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches and Reentry. Actually, I'm the only shared employee in the entire country between a police department and a faith community. The Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches is an umbrella organization of 700 different churches. And in June of this year, I was invited by the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the Community-Oriented Policing Office to participate in developing a national reentry strategy. We just got the book yesterday, so I just brought that. One of the pieces I think that's very helpful is, first of all, we begin to talk about what is reentry. And we hear a variety of things, and we hear that in our own heads. I want to read to you just one of the bullets. Law enforcement should emphasize the fact that offender reentry efforts are designed to reduce crime and enhance public safety. In other words, the goal is not to reduce recidivism. Recidivism is an outcome, not a goal, because there are people that you want to go back. An important piece in designing reentry, and we do run a reentry program out of the adult correction facility, is who is your target market? Because if you just mentor anybody, you're not reducing crime and increasing public safety. And because I am a shared employee, one of the pieces that you'll see in your packets is that every week I get a list from the city and county attorney's office that says not for public, so you can only have the front page. Is that every week I receive a list of the chronic offenders in the city of Minneapolis who are sent to the adult correction facility in Plymouth. And every Tuesday, myself and my co-director interview those individuals as potential candidates for receiving mentors. One thing people is very helpful to understand is that one of the differences between the adult correction facility in Plymouth and the Department of Corrections is not always the crime, it's the time. In other words, if you have less than a year to serve, you're going to serve it in a county facility, not in a Department of Corrections. I see people every week, 70 to 75% at the adult correction facility, the county workhouse, Parker's Lake Resort, however you may know it, are made up of people who are felons, 70-75%. I've seen people in there for first-degree murder, second-degree sales, felons in possession of firearms. Now, you may ask me the question about why is case management critical? And it's an essential piece of reentry. One of the pieces, and this is a factor, is that according to state statute, if I've been sent to the Department of Corrections, I'm under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. If I'm sent to the adult correction facility, I'm under the jurisdiction of the judge. Inmates have the ability to call the judge, which they do, and say, may I be placed on electric home monitoring? May I be furloughed for a job furlough? May I be furloughed for chemical assessment? Even though all of those are within the facility. And often the judge will choose not to call the prosecutor or the adult correction facility staff and will give that person a furlough for a job without ensuring that they have any of the criteria that are necessary, such as identification, resumes. On the last page of your packet, you'll see that part of our program is a picture of a woman who is a chronic prostitute, as an example, who the judge furloughed for one day. There is a bench warrant out for her. We do this kind of community notification in the appropriate precincts so that people then can be informed and call in if they see her. So case management is huge. It may be shocking, but jurisdictions don't always talk to each other. And I know it's amazing. And what we do every Tuesday is that we sit down with the staff at the adult correction facility, and we actually go through case management. We often have the city attorney there, the county attorney there. They've never before come into each other's silos. And they begin to talk about what are the joint issues. How is it that us as an attorney, because of the state statute, can do different dispositions when charging so the adult correction facility has the ability to have more control over its offenders? Those are important kinds of questions. The other thing that we do, in addition, is that mentoring also has a case management perspective on that. We believe mentoring is critical and underlying to success. We partner with a variety of organizations and deeply respect them. Midwest Challenge has done an outstanding job on their work. We take a look at hired and other agencies. And so what we do is that we also partner with probation. We recruit our mentors. Backgrounds are done by the Hennepin County. We then do training at the adult correction facility, because a lot of people walking into an adult correction facility need to hear the door slam behind them to figure out if mentoring is right for them. We do training, and it's done in collaboration with the adult correction facility staff. Because we interview all the offenders, we do the mentor matching. One of the pieces we heard earlier is that on staff at the adult correction facility in Plymouth is a woman who has a grant that works with Judge Hopper, who's a mental health grant. We do referrals, and we actually can coordinate those referrals. The second piece that we do is we work closely with probation. And that one of the things that you'll see is we actually have a form for the mentees to sign. And one of the things they have to agree to is to have contact with both my case manager at the adult correction facility and the probation and parole officer unless they're executing their time. We put parole because even though short-term commits for the State Department of Correction are about 1%, the total of that population at the adult correction facility in Plymouth is 13%. So that we really approach it, and that oftentimes probation officers, if they have the time, before an individual, because we start the mentoring before they're released. You build the relationships on the inside. You fall them back into the community. And what we find is that probation officers will come out and do joint planning with the mentor and then connect them to the important employment and housing services. But we believe mentoring is really the underpinning of what happens, because for a lot of these people, work is something new, that they need that kind of ongoing support. The other piece that the police department does is we do electronic tracking of everyone that we're mentoring, so that as soon as a person's released, it's an automatic notification. And so if they have any encounter with the police department, either as offender, victim, witness, suspect, or other, we automatically notify probation. It automatically notifies the adult correction facility. And mentors then play a role. Mentors can go and say, you know, Hillary was doing great. She picked up a driving after suspension. The city attorney, because we have those relationships, will then squash that kind of charge, and we'll let probation know that as well. So it's an integrated, holistic approach whose focus is to design to reduce crime and enhance public safety. You'll notice on the front page is our statistics of last year. We actually saw 172 people. We see a lot of people. We're a staff of three. And we interviewed 92 matches. So when we can't match somebody in their variety of reasons, they might be mental health reasons or a whole variety of reasons, we do provide service. We'll call up people and say, you know, this would be a great candidate for your program. Can we work with you? What we know is of the 42 matches of people who stayed with their mentor when they left, only one of those 42 came back. Of the 35, while Insight said we want a mentor and blew them off, 20 of those came back. So our recidivism rate runs about 23%. So that gives you a flavor about what are we talking about with reentry. A piece that I just want to share very quickly came from Chief Dolan, and since I report to him and Gary Ryerson, who is executive director for the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches, he says, consider that every homicide conviction costs taxpayers over $3 million. That is a very safe estimate, figuring at today's cost, and without any increases. My arrest and convictions for homicide just last year cost taxpayers more than my annual budget. At all other convictions and incarceration, you can see we are spending huge dollars on a response to crime and criminal behavior. Why try to prevent crime as a solution to the criminal justice revolving door? The answer is that the one thing we do know is that the problem is not going to be resolved by putting more people in prison. We need to try prevention strategies. And just out of the workhouse this year will be close to 7,500 people just out of the workhouse in Plymouth coming in and out. And if you think that we, you know, last year 41 people committed no new crimes and an average number of arrests per person is 40, that's 1,600 fewer crimes in the city of Minneapolis. And this is an investment in that kind of piece. Thank you for your time.
So, Mr. Chair, you can see how complicated
I've known her for so long. It's hard to say Ms. Freeman. Ms. Freeman's the three people who work with Ms. Freeman in the reentry at the workhouse, and she needs some community partners. And it's clear this bill and the bill you'll be hearing after it are organizations who are going to do their best to make sure that when people get out of incarceration, they don't go back. And I don't know if there's anybody else here who wants to testify on the bill.
Well, let's ask.
Someone from the Department of Corrections, I think, was going to make a comment or two. Yes.
Okay. Come on up.
Here you go, Gary.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm for the record, I'm Gary Johnson. I'm the Director of Reentry Services for the Department of Corrections. A couple of weeks ago, I testified in front of some of the members of this committee about our MCOR initiative with the Department of Corrections, the Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Plan. And at that time, I had described some of the things that we're doing in our institutions and with our steering committee with collaboration with other agencies to affect a reentry initiative in the state of Minnesota. And just in the interest of making the committee fully aware, I wanted to just comment about a little bit of the language in the bill itself, referring to paragraph B. That explains essentially the part I'm trying to make you aware of is that a number of the things that are enumerated in the bill that this particular agency would do is procure identification for offenders, get Social Security cards when they don't have them, get them involved in some employment skills training. Those kinds of things we're already doing through our transitions programs in our institution. I just wanted to make you aware of this. This bill, we really think, is a wonderful idea. We have no objections to the things that are here and the ideas behind providing this kind of holistic approach to offender reentry. So we're not here to squelch this in any way, but just wanted to make you aware that some of these things we currently do in our institutions, and we do them ourselves because of security reasons in our facilities. It's just simply much easier for our own staff to navigate through our institutions and provide some of these services than it is for an outside agency to get clearance and come in and do some of these things. So. I just wanted to make that point to the committee.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to provide some testimony on this bill? Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 619 be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Are there any questions of the committee before we vote? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Higgins, this project, if you will, has been going around, and this is not really a pilot project as much, but an ongoing program, is it not?
Have you guys been doing
it? It would be a pilot project because no one else. Well, we've actually have seen other programs that have done similar things in other states. There's nothing that we know of in Minnesota yet, and one of our plans is to go to Racine and see their reentry panel and how that works and to connect it. So it is new, and our hope is that this would be a model for not only other programs, but that it would work with other types, too. Like in our program right now, we work with male offenders. We want to get a program. This model could also be used with female offenders and also with youth. And so that is the hope that this will grow and serve as a model for other programs to follow.
Any other questions of the committee? The motion then is that the Senate file be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Our next bill will be Senate File 1300. Senator Higgins, this is your bill.
You're going to get tired of hearing me talk today, I'm afraid.
Mr. Chair, this is another pilot project that is being proposed by an organization with a new name, but it's a venerable old organization. Emerge Community Development is an affiliate of Pillsbury United Communities, which has worked in my community and many others for many a year. They have been looking at also coming up with a pilot project for reentry, and to my right is Dawn
Williams.
Williams, yes, of course, and she's going. I think you're going to start out. Is that right?
I am.
Okay.
Ms. Williams, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and Senators. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here and speak to this bill, which is very important to many of the participants that we work with. As Senator Higgins said, Emerge Community Development is an affiliate corporation of Pillsbury United Communities. And we did that to take our employment, our training, and our housing programs, put them in a corporation themselves to provide holistic services to individuals and families to enable them to become self-sufficient. One of the new programs that Emerge Community Development started last summer was a program called StreetWorks Youth Employment Program. It was designed to reach young people from the age of 14 to 21 on the north side of Minneapolis. It was a City of Minneapolis-funded program, and we put 64 young people to work 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, for a period of 6 weeks. I didn't really think they would continue to show up, but you know what? They didn't miss a day. It was the most wonderful program that I've seen operate for some time. These kids took control of the North Side. They took ownership of the North Side. They cleaned it up, and then they were disappointed when there was trash in the same place again the next day for them to start over with. This program really got us started looking at other programs in other parts of the country for adults, and that's what this bill is hopefully going to help us get started as a pilot program. It's an adult program, so it's expanding the summer youth program to adults. Another program that Emerge has is a program called Northside Job Connection, which works primarily with men and women who have criminal histories in helping them become employable and get jobs. One of the discoveries that we've had, and it's not new, but it is that folks coming out of our jails and prisons are lacking a couple of things that are major. One of them is skills, and the other is work habits. So the whole premise of the StreetWorks adult program is to provide them with a supportive work environment, one that will teach them not only the skills but also give them the work habits, like you really need to show up every day, you need to be there on time, and you need to have a good attitude. We're not starting with minimum wage. The plan is to begin at $8 an hour and to give them raises based on merit and longevity. It's planned to be an 18-month program with graduating and transitioning into jobs elsewhere using the skills and work habits that they developed in the StreetWorks program. We've been working with the City of Minneapolis Regulatory Services as well as local businesses, and that's where the work's going to come from. It's landscaping, it's boarded up houses, it's providing services for the City of Minneapolis based on the inspections department and the code violations that are issued. The supportive program or the supportive employment program is really what we find is needed. Northside Job Connections is going to be the program that will become the resource for the people that will be working as crew members of the StreetWorks Adult Program. I've brought with us Marvin Clark, who is the program manager for Northside Job Connections.
Mr. Clark?
Good afternoon, Sir Chair and members. Again, I want to thank you for inviting us here today. This bill is very important because there is no program out there or project out there like the StreetWorks project, because now the people that's coming out of the institution, whether it's the Department of Correction or county jails, they'll have the opportunity to go right into work and get that work experience. We all know that one of the reasons a lot of people reoffend and go back because of the discouragement of going back into the institution. It will also allow us to work on their soft skills, their interviewing skills, in the same sense of giving them the opportunity to go to work. Northside Job Connection is a program that's been working with individuals with criminal history, working on their soft skills, addressing the other barriers that they may be facing, such as chemical health, mental health, homelessness, all across the board. We have developed a partnership with different other social service agencies where if they need housing, then I can call on someone to house them, or I can call on someone to do a Rule 25 for a chemical assessment, or call on someone to do an assessment for the mental health or get them back on their meds. So we have already developed a panel, an ongoing panel that works with them. We have to address all the issues of the individual. But the one issue, if someone comes out and need housing, before they can get housing, they need to get employment. So this is an inroad so that when they come out, they will put them to work at $8 an hour. They'll be able to not get a one-bedroom apartment, but they'll be able to get a room where they can call it their own, and we can go on from there and then address the other issues as we go. We have been my success rate with the offenders. Last year I placed 89 people, and out of that 89 people, 75 of them, I believe, retain their employment, you know, because I have a staff that we works with them on their individuals, their soft skills, their interviewing skills, and what have you. So this is why this bill here is very important for reentry.
Thank you.
Would you please state your name for the record?
The chair. Yes, my name is Boyce Jones. I'm a project manager of Emerge, an affiliate of Pillsbury United Communities. Again, I'd like to thank the chair and our honorable colleagues and the committee for holding these hearings. Again, we think they're very important. I think you already know the numbers. Statistically, we know that there's a number of people who come and go through not just the system nationwide. Over 650,000 people go through the system nationwide. But when we talk about specifically Minnesota, and if I can just briefly talk about the 2 years I've attended the national reentry conferences, the one in 2005 was in Nashville, the one, 2006 was in Nashville, 2005 was Nashville, last year in Dallas, and it's going to be hosted in Minneapolis, actually, in 2007. So I think what I'm saying is that there's been a great deal of leadership that this House has actually shown as it relates to ex-offender and reentry. And again, the eyes of the nation is actually going to be on us in 2007. So again, I hope this august body continues to do the kind of work that I think we've been lauding it for as it relates to focusing on reentry. Specifically, if I may add, the work that people like Marvin and Ms. Williams have done over the last few years, is actually what we call de facto reentry. We've been doing reentry for a long time, believe it or not. Consequently, the majority of people that we've took in, I actually had worked with doing the work that Marvin did from 2004 to 2006, and we've placed hundreds of people in work. But again, what we found that was daunting is that the majority of the people, although they may not have just recently been released from a institution, they may have been charged with a crime 10 years ago. And that was the greatest barrier that they faced is when they walked into an employer and it said, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And these are people that, for the most part, have been working at staffing agencies, part-time jobs, no benefits, no real integrity as it related to work. That's what we want to do. We want to, one, give them the ability to kind of get off of that track. Where they can develop requisite skills that can take them to the next level. That's what this project is about. It's about transitioning them from those staffing agencies, those part-time jobs with no benefits, and putting them in a place where they can actually work with some dignity. As Marvin was saying, an $8 an hour job in the Twin Cities is not going to get you a one-bedroom apartment. That's $13.57 an hour. How many people with no skills, limited work history, criminal history, is going to be able to garner a $13.75 an hour? It's a very difficult task. So again, what we've decided to do is we modeled a program out of Los Angeles called StreetWorks that actually takes about 1,500 people who are homeless with criminal histories and serious problems and put them to work. And that's the model that we decided to use. I think we heard a person talk about earlier that it's very difficult because there's no incentive for an employer to hire ex-offenders. Well, I think that, you know, there is a great deal of incentive because that's part of the workforce that's out there that is untapped. And that's what we actually want to do. We don't want to bring them to an employer's and saying, here's a guy who has problems. We want to say, here's a guy who has an opportunity and options and wants to be a very vital and integral part of this neighborhood, this community. And that's what StreetWorks is really about. And let me say for references that StreetWorks is actually an enterprise than a program. And I think that's what makes it different. What sets it apart from the also-ran is that by being an enterprise, we're able to hire these individuals ourselves, provide them with those, I think, again, requisite accoutrements like, some benefits, a decent wage. Those are the things that we actually would like to do. And again, that sets us apart, we think, from the also-ran. And finally, Mr. Chair, we just really like to say that this particular effort, again, is not one that we came up on in a vacuum. There's been a lot of work, again, that this body has been doing on reentry. I personally, again, since this is kind of de facto, I didn't start out working in the reentry area. It's just the majority of the people that we found had that particular characteristic, a criminal documented criminal history, and we found it was the major barrier. But again, I want to say thank you very much for taking the time to consider the most, I think, vulnerable population here in not just the Twin Cities, but actually, again, this is a national problem. But thanks for taking the leadership and looking at these issues and actually now not just talking about it as a problem, but coming up with comprehensive solutions. And we thank you. And I would like to submit for the record my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. I've got the gavel back over here now. Senator Higgins, do you have any follow-up comments or any questions from the committee? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jones, I guess my question is to you or perhaps anybody that would like to answer it.
Yes, ma'am.
With reentry issues, I would assume certain circumstances have to be reviewed. And I would assume gender and perhaps the reason they were incarcerated, and or you could go down the list. Is there one that really stands out that might be new to us here at this table that we should consider that is not? I mean, I would assume if you have an addiction or mental health, is there anything else along those lines that we should perhaps evaluate reentry issues under case management issue? Or do you understand what my question is? You have that puzzle look, Mr. Jones.
Are you asking if there's any additional or crimes that we come across that?
No, Mr. Chair. No, I guess my question is there anything that we should be looking for that we aren't necessarily addressing
when you're talking about reentry issues that perhaps we've overlooked in our previous years of work on this.
Well, maybe I can address that. I think I've had an opportunity again to work with people like Senator Marty and Keith Ellison and Judy Soderstrom, a very bipartisan group, believe it or not, that looked at what I call those conditions of release. And let's just talk about that really quickly. 30% of ex-offenders are returned to prison not because they're reoffended, but they cannot satisfy their conditions of release. Those are tend to be 30 to 60 days to get housing or jobs. Now, I found that to be, again, in terms of systems change, one of the most onerous scenarios. I have 2 degrees and can't get a job in 30 days or 60 days. You know, so I found that the being able to look at, again, systems change in those areas could be very beneficial for those particular individuals, because I think we heard earlier that these individuals may have gotten out there, they may have been knocking down those doors, and then subsequently they become very discouraged because, again, the characteristics that kind of come along with that, having that question being asked, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And as a direct result, I think that we pass either because of accountability factors with the Department of Corrections, these what I consider, again, it's opinion, very draconian, you know, rules. But what it does, it hamstrings those individuals who are really trying very hard. So I would hope that you would begin to look at maybe some of those conditions of release, maybe through the Department of the Corrections or their accountability measures with this body to determine that. Again, I'm not trying to say let them off the hook or be an apologist for them, but those are very serious obstacles to gaining access to opportunity.
You know, there's just one. I'd just like to add one
Ms.
more
Williams.
Thing. There's a very. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. There's a
like
very.
Like Senator Higgins indicated earlier, I try to say it for the record. So if anyone does listen to the tape after, so
thank
ahead.
You, sir. There's just a very elementary reason that people have difficulty getting work to when they come out. They don't know how. They don't know how to work. They don't know where to start, and I think they need. A program, an agency, an enterprise like ours to give them that elementary, that very beginning instruction as to how, what's expected of employees. You'd need to work 40 hours. You go to work with the sniffles. You go to work at night. You know, you go to bed at night. You get prepared. You get your, you know, it's just those very elementary things. And that's part of what we're going to be doing with StreetWorks.
Okay.
Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Williams, so let me get this right. This pilot project is actually a jobs program for 18 months.
It is. That's correct.
And they will be getting about $8 an hour plus benefits?
They will get $8 an hour. They will not have benefits. They will not have insurance. We will help those folks get plugged in that need it, but they will start at $8 an hour, and they will be able to graduate up and have 2 raises, I think, we've got plugged into the plan.
And then, Ms. Williams, what happens after the 18 months?
We have a number of job counselors within our group that will be working with folks as they get near the end to help them with resumes, with interviewing skills, and to help them find additional work as they get approach time to where they're going to be leaving this program.
And Ms. Chair, and maybe Mr. Clark or Mr. Jones can answer this question for me. It appears that that you've succeeded in doing some job placements. What kind of jobs are these individuals getting?
Mr. Chair, members, they're getting all types of jobs, but we try to match the person with the right job. We don't just we can go out all day and get you a job, but if the job is not something that you're going to be satisfied with or that you're going to enjoy doing, then you're going to end up leaving, and we're going to keep going through that recycle. So you know, if someone we have placed people in construction field, we have placed people in factory jobs, or we have placed people in assembly, we have placed people as van drivers, we have placed people in a nursing field per se in the community, we have placed people, we have even hired ourselves. My assistant
is a ex-offender, right? Straight right from the institution back into the agency. So the jobs vary. It depends on what their skills is and what their interest is going in. And so we try to match the right person with them, because it's not just about the job. It's about stability. It's about the rest of their life. Because if we want to, and I heard him talk about it early, cut down the recidivism rate, then we have to, first of all, get them something what they're going to be stead at. And as Miss Williams was just talking about the work program in the 18 months, well, any time in the course of that 18 months, these individuals can be placed, because my staff in itself will be working with these individuals, working on their soft skills, working on their work readiness skills and things of that nature. We're going to just continue on what we're already doing. And what we will do in terms of that, we will be working with Gary Johnson's and the transition teams at the Department of Correction, and to enhance or to support the transition teams, to making sure that these individuals, if they notify or contact us, that they're getting into the transition programs that at the different institutions around the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator, one follow-up. You know, Senator Higgins, I can't help but keep thinking back to 619, the project in your bill that we just passed, and combining Mr. Johnson's comments on what the department is trying to do with the individuals who are, you know, incarcerated. It sounds to me like a lot of some of the job counseling and resume and skills building, the department is trying to address that. And what I heard when we went on our tours at the prisons and hearing about the department's job reentry program is that they're expending resources to do the preparations, but there seems to be a gap once the individual comes out, that there aren't community organizations that are supportive to get them the job and to stay with them as they're in that job. And so I see this as sort of a really good pilot project that would be an intermediary that will, you know, we'll let the department do what they need to do with the documents and with the resumes and the skills. But at the end of the day, I think that once they leave the department's jurisdiction, the community programs need to step in to help shepherd that intervening steps before they hook into to their jobs. And my one other thought is that I really do think that for this to be meaningful, we really do need to get back to looking at the statutorily prohibited jobs, different categories. I heard very clearly even the department's own frustrations with that, and I would think that that is probably a barrier that you are encountering. And yes, if this is a direction where we want to move in, we ought to really take a good look at that. In addition to your recommendation on the condition of release, I really appreciated that.
Yeah. If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Senator Moore. I think, you know, even as you talk about the types and kinds of employment that, again, I was at the helm of NJC for about 2 years, and one of the things that I did at my tenure working there is that under our contracts, we were given the responsibility of providing a certain number of jobs through the city and a certain a pay rate. We actually averaged around $12 an hour. So, again, you know, we were given $8 an hour as a goal, but we were managing to actually put people in jobs that, on the average, were about $12 an hour. So what we're thinking is that our responsibility actually isn't to do the bare minimum. It's actually not even within our corporate culture to do the bare minimum. We're going to do this work anyway, believe it or not, because it's our neighborhood, it's our community, these are our people, we don't really have a choice. But I think what we really want is actually the best for them, not the bare minimum. So, again, we may be charged with, I think, again, some very maybe simple and very mediocre objectives, but our goal is to do the best that we can for this particular population, because actually, again, we think that contrary to popular belief, there's a lot of individuals who want to really, really have a good shot at a second opportunity, and we want to do everything we possibly can to give them that second shot.
Thank you. Senator Higgins, I know you've got a bill up in another committee as well. Two more up.
Chair,
is there any other questions from the committee?
I can do it from here. At this point, Mr. Chair, I will move that Senate File 1300 be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Higgins, I know you're going to go to your other committee for your other
state
bills.
And local government operations and oversight to present a couple elections bills. Senator Ingebrigtsen is a co-author of the governor's bill, Senate File 650, and he's going to present the bill with the department folks, and I think Mr. Turner is going to do the yeoman's work on presenting that bill, and I will be back as soon as I can.
All right.
So thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, you take your seat at the witness table, and Mr. Turner, wherever you want to provide your guidance from. I will also note to the members of the committee that we're going to be running probably through the dinner hour. If you have dinner with you, feel free to eat it. I have been instructed, however, that the sergeant does not like food at the table, so we are going to create some space at the staff table for senators to be able to eat their dinner, if you wish to do so.
Just go through it, huh?
Yeah, I'll just, yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'll go through the governor's bill. What you've had passed out is, should have a spreadsheet. It reflects the governor's proposed budget. It's dated February 19th, 2007. You should have a summary of the bill and then a second summary of Senate File 1151, which is the Public Safety Radio Communication System, which is part of the governor's bill and authored by Senator Lance. Now, you can either follow the spreadsheet. I guess I'll just go right down the summary right now. But I will be more or less just telling you what's on the spreadsheet, because it's a funding bill. It's the governor's bill.
Who has that?
Article 1, Sections 1 and 2 are just a summary of the appropriations by fund and a definition of fiscal year. Sections 3 to 9 are relate to the courts and the public defender, and they are not under the jurisdiction of this committee. They're under the jurisdiction of Senator Foley. So we will be hearing those separately in his committee. It's very likely that these two bills will be married up and will be conferred together. But for today, the judiciary and the public defender is not under our jurisdiction. So to start, I guess we skip immediately to Section 10, which is the appropriations for the Department of Public Safety. It appropriates $184 million from the general fund, $106 million from the state government special revenue fund, $11.5 million from the special revenue fund, $741,000 from the trunk highway fund, and $140,000 from the environmental fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety to operate the agency during the 2008-2009 biennium. Now, of this amount, $7.8 million is appropriated to the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. $500,000 of that appropriation is added to the base for disaster assistance for the state match for disaster assistance. And $2.2 million is for increasing readiness for a pandemic flu event. The bill appropriates $99.7 million to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. This includes two initiatives, $15.5 million for CrimNet, and $2.9 million for 20 forensic scientists for the Bureau. The bill appropriates $10.3 million from the Special Revenue Fund for the Fire Marshal. Of this amount, $4.5 million is to be distributed by the Fire Service Advisory Committee established under Minnesota Statutes 299F.012. The bill appropriates $3.3 million from the general fund to the Division of Alcohol and Gambling, and $72.9 million from the general fund to the Office of Justice Programs. Within the Office of Justice Programs, there are the new initiatives in the bill are $2.5 million for the Gang Strike Force, $910,000 for the Victim Notification System, $400,000 for school safety centers, and $500,000 for crime victim reparations. The $2.5 million for the Gang Strike Force and the $910,000 for the Victim Notification System are meant to be state replacements of federal funds which have been eliminated. Then we have Subdivision 7 of Section 10 appropriates $106 million from the State Government Special Revenue Fund to the Department of Public Safety for the 911 Emergency Services Armor Program. As I stated earlier, this is traveling as a separate bill, a Senate file 1151. I have a copy of the summary of 1151. We'll go over that later. It's Senator Latz's bill. Section 11 appropriates $8.5 million to the Peace Officers Standard and Training Board, and the majority of that money is used to reimburse local units of government for law enforcement training. Section 12 appropriates $258,000 to the Private Detective Board. Section 13 appropriates $8.6 million to the Department of Human Rights. Of that appropriation, approximately $1.5 million is for the replacement of the department's tracking and compliance databases with a new management information system. Then we get to Section 14, which is the Department of Corrections.
So, Mr. Turner, can I ask you a question? Is there a place where this is where it indicates if these amounts are increases over previous years and how much or what percent increase over the last biennium?
Mr. Chairman, there isn't on this spreadsheet. However, Senator Higgins asked me today to put that together for the committee, and I'll have it for you next week.
Thank
okay?
you.
Mr. Chairman, then we'll go on to the Department of Corrections. Section 14 appropriates $941 million from the general fund to the department to operate the agency and fund community corrections. Of this amount, $625 million is to operate the prison institutions themselves, and $244 million is for probation and supervised release. Operation Support, which is administration planning and research within the department, receives $34.9 million for the biennium. The major fiscal initiative, I guess, for lack of a better term, in the corrections budget is a 4.25% annual salary increase for security staff and a 2% annual increase for administrative staff. This amounts to $30.9 million over the biennium.
Mr. Turner, do you know the that's obviously quite a difference in the percentage increases. Has the governor provided an explanation for that?
Mr. Chairman, members, the state-operated services or essential functions with confined residents, I guess, has received more than the 2% which other state employees got. So that means the Department of Corrections got 4.25. I believe that the Department of Human Services and the Veterans Home Board got 3%, I believe. The Department of Corrections, because they're essential staff, got a 4.25. percent increase from the governor. That's I don't really know why.
Okay, maybe someone else from the department would be able to.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think we do have some people here today.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members.
You just state your name for the record.
I'm Dennis Benson, a deputy commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Welcome, Commissioner.
The higher percent for the essential services is primarily driven by an inflator in the retirement. It's a retirement account. There was a larger percent that both employees are paying into the retirement account and the employer, which accounts for some of that increase. In addition to that, raises are negotiated every 2 years. Step increases are part of that negotiated plan, and the total amount is, I believe it's 4.25 that comes to. That's actually just a wee bit underfunded as well, and we fund our institutions at about 97% to 98%. And because they are 24/7 operations, we simply are unable to absorb any of that inflationary amount. In addition to step increases and annual increases, there's also the health care that the state has to pay as well. So those are the ingredients that account for that higher number. And again, I think ours is a little bit higher than some of the other 24/7 operations, because Corrections Early Retirement Account, the retirement board is last year negotiated a higher percent again that the state has to pay. So that's where those dollars are going.
Thank you. That's rather significant disparity in the increases between the security staff and the 2% for the administrative staff. Not at all to say that the security staff aren't worth it, but one might ask, why aren't the administrative staff getting better raises, if you will, too? Are these, how much of this is negotiated union contract amounts, and how much of
Mr. Chair and members, I wouldn't be able to give you those exact percentages, but the folks in our central office, for example, the management staff, fiscal staff, human resource staff, IT staff, obviously we work in an 8-hour shift, so we're not asked to cover three shifts as we are in the institutions, and you're correct. That 2% doesn't cover all of the costs, but it is an amount that was set by the governor and Department of Finance that we believe we can live with. And through some turnover, some holding positions open, we're able to survive. And again, there was no increase in the general retirement plan percent that the state has to pay. So that gives some relief to the folks in that retirement plan as well.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Chris Turner may be able to give you a better feedback as to what's going on there and the implications of what's already negotiated and may be included in.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I'm sorry that I don't think I can be much help with that.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Why don't you move on, Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members. Okay. So we've got $30.9 million over the biennium for salary increases. In addition, the bill requests $3.95 million to annualize or absorb the additional costs passed by the 2006 legislative session. We have $3 million in fuel and utility costs above and beyond the base, $2.5 million for inmate health care, a $1 million increase for retiree insurance, and $800,000 for offender reentry services. which we've been hearing about this afternoon.
Mr. Turner, do you know what the some of those additional costs passed by the 2006 legislative session included?
I'd have to ask Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Benson. So,
Mr. Chair, could you restate the question? I'm not clear on your question.
Sure. Mr. Turner indicated, and our summary indicates, the bill requests $3.95 million to absorb additional costs passed by the legislature last year. Can you give us some idea what those are?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This year, in our or last year rather, there was a supplemental request by the Department of Corrections to again keep up with the inflationary increases, and it was funded through this biennium, but it was not carried in the tails, and this is a tails number to make our budget whole. Otherwise, we'd be stuck with a 1.975 hole in our budget. So it was just when it was negotiated last year, we were funded through the biennium, but not into the future.
All right. The members of the committee understand that. How do we fund it without funding the tails? Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask Commissioner Benson to repeat that. I didn't catch it. I apologize.
Well, let's try again, Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe the amount last year was around $8 or $9 million that made our budget whole. We've always been behind on this inflationary figure, this number that we're asking for this year, the $30 million. But last biennium, we didn't get all of our inflation in our initial budget, so we came back the second year and said we just got to get this inflationary amount. So they funded us, they fully funded us for the biennium, $8 million, which made our budget whole. But they did not carry that amount in the tails. In other words, future bienniums, it was not carried. So this 1.975, again, going into the 08-09 biennium makes our budget whole. That's the best I can do. Maybe Jim King can explain it more.
Senator Moore?
Commissioner Benson, is that to make you whole in the out year? So really what you're asking is that we fund your inflationary costs for this biennium?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, the $30 million is inflation going forward. The 1.9 is sort of catch-up from last year. So maybe our executive budget officer can make it more clear than I can.
Mr. King?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Watt, I'm Jim King from the Department of Finance. I'll try to explain it slightly differently. Last year, the department did come in, as they stated, for additional funding money for the current biennium. The money was appropriated to the agency. However, in the process of negotiating the out-year tails on that, there was actually a rider in the bill, in your appropriation bill that you passed last year, that reduced the so-called base level for 08-09 by this amount. It's included in the governor's budget because it is an ongoing current cost that should be funded in the department's budget in fiscal years 8 and 9.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, and then the Moore. the other amount then is the projected inflationary costs?
The roughly $30 million amount that was discussed earlier, yes, that is that amount for additional costs in fiscal years 8 and 9.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Jim King from the Department of Finance.
Mr. King, I thought we weren't looking at inflation in the governor's budgets.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moi, that the governor has recommended compensation-related cost increases for state agencies in his budget recommendations for fiscal years 8 and 9. It's not in the forecast. I think you're maybe confusing the forecast with the governor's budget recommendations. The governor's budget does make compensation-related cost increase recommendations. That's included in his budget.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. King, I don't mean to be political here, but I guess all this time I've been paying attention, and we've been told that inflationary costs aren't real costs, and that's why we don't put it into the budget forecast. And yet, obviously, it's real because we're not only filling it, we're backfilling it, and we're building it into the agency's budgets, even based on the governor's recommendations. So now I'm a little bit confused. I mean, do we have inflationary costs or don't we? And I guess what I'm hearing from the department is that they do have inflationary costs, and the governor even recognizes that. So I think it's real, and I want to make sure that we don't put them in this situation again by just giving them the one time and then not funding that. And I hope that we can bring some uniformity to the discussion, because the reality is I don't think the department here is alone in being the situation. I mean, if we're going to talk about transparency, then we really ought to talk about transparency both in the forecast and the actual budgets that are being presented to us, because it is built into the request, and therefore I think it is real. But that was just a friendly rhetorical comment, Mr. King. It's not your job to answer that. It was said with a smile.
Thank you. I would gently point out that we have included information in our forecast about inflation, even though that's currently not part of our law. So it is of concern, and in this particular case, we do have these cost increases in the budget.
That would be the asterisk in the fine print part, right? That's rhetorical also. Mr. Turner, would you care to move on to the next portion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would like to point out, before the salary increase or the inflationary costs were built into the base, and so in many respects this budget is more transparent than in previous years, because now it's a change item, and so, you know, it's staring us straight in the face, so to speak. And the other thing I wanted to point out was, as far as the tails go, if every year at the end of the conference committee, we get a target that we have to meet for this biennium, and then we get a tail target. And unfortunately, we had problems with the tails last year, and we took it out of the department's hide, and I think everybody knew what we were doing at the time, and the governor included it in his budget for that reason. So,
Mr. Turner, the $3 million in fuel and utility costs, and the $2.5 million for health care, are those increases in costs over previous years as well? Is that why they are?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes.
Okay. So, in a sense, those are inflation-related.
Mr. Chairman,
compensation too.
Yeah, the price of fuel went up quite substantially last year. We're always trying to keep up on our health care costs.
Mr. Turner, how about the offender reentry services? Is that tied specifically to any of the bills or proposals that we've been hearing in committee for new initiatives, or is that related to an increase in the cost of providing the existing reentry services?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll try to clarify. Mr. Turner is correct. Our fuel costs, I think between 05 and 06, went up about 32% in 1 year. And we were in better shape this year through January, but of course we all know what happened in February with respect to heat costs. So we haven't had a substantial increase in inflation for fuel in over 10 or 12 years. And we just simply cannot absorb the annual increases that are occurring. We have 10 different locations with millions of square feet to heat. And this $1.5 million a year will go a long ways, although it might not get us all the way home. It'll give us a good start. The reentry piece is simply these are new initiatives. We have some reentry pieces, but in place now in the institutions. But you're correct. Much of the debate that's gone on this session around reentry initiatives are included in these amounts. Some in the institutions division, and of course some in community services. And Deputy Commissioner Nelson just handed me a summary here. We've got a new case manager, community service contracts of $150,000, case manager 72.5, transitional housing and community services is 45,000. And then in our institutions, two coordinators, transition coordinators, 100,000, child support investigator, St. Cloud and Shakopee, 22,000, one support staff, 35,000, and a pilot research project for 50,000. And then in community services, we also have 100,000 for a mentoring academy, 100,000 to make a Wilder Job Club permanent funding, and then grants to counties that would be new initiatives for $825,000.
Thank you, Commissioner Benson. Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if I remember I circled this in my budget book last time because there's only one little short paragraph or one sentence talking about it. I wonder if someone could come and talk to us a little bit more about the pandemic flu preparation allocation. And in the budget book, it just says to ensure the coordination of state agencies, infectious disease, pandemic preparedness activities, and the provision of assistance to local emergency managers to increase readiness for a pandemic event. And I'd like to know a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, for the record, my name is Chris Ide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
Ready?
The pandemic flu preparations appropriation will be used to pass money through to local units of government, to the Department of Employee Relations, to make sure that our service continuation plans are coordinated from state agencies to state agency, that we have consistent human resource policies for a pandemic event, that we have a supplement to the emergency operations plan that all the state agencies agree to and sign off on so that we can respond to the community in the event of a pandemic. Also, there's money in there to continue with working with other state agencies, local government, and the business community on ensuring that our critical infrastructure will be still viable during a pandemic event, including all the different sectors of the utilities to make sure that we have the essential workers in the electrical utility, the water systems, trucking, grocery stores, anything that's really going to be essential services in the event of a pandemic. This is to put a coordinated system in state agencies. This $1.1 million each year is separate from the Department of Health. The Department of Health is purchasing antivirals and other personal protective equipment, and then ensuring that they have the staff in the laboratories and in their planning for these events.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ide, how many FTEs are we contemplating with these dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, we have three FTEs, one to coordinate the program, one to work with local units of government, and one to work with state agencies and the business community.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Ide, I seem to remember, and I heard a radio show on this. I guess there was an expert who was in town two, 3 weeks ago, and his arguments are pretty compelling. But I seem to remember that there was also some discussions with concerns about
preparation, not only about the pandemic flu, but also about, you know, potential biohazard issues, as well as our emergency response statewide and at the local level to terroristic threats and et cetera. Are we kind of piecemealing this, or is there a larger plan in place? I would think that the same kind of coordinations that would go into addressing the pandemic flu preparation would also be good systems for the other kind of statewide emergency things that we're looking at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moa, that's absolutely correct. These FTEs that are in Homeland Security and Emergency Management coordinate with all the other planners that, we do have in, our system. There are some unique things about infectious disease outbreak, and these folks not only will work with pandemic, but they'll also work with the other infectious diseases that could be introduced into the population by bad people. And they do have that background, so they have some medical background. We have a microbiologist as one of our planners, so that is our conduit from the folks at Health, mixing that in with the emergency responders and with the local units of government, so that we can make sure that our emergency operations plan is really all hazards. But we have some folks that focus on nuclear power plants. These folks focus on pandemic and infectious disease, but it is all one umbrella of an emergency preparedness framework.
Now, Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
Ms. Idy, in all of these different plans, is there sort of an intentional focus on some of the more vulnerable areas? I mean, I happen to represent, you know, our capital city, the city mm-hmm. of St. Paul, and I think that with all our state agencies and our state office buildings and the state capitol being here, we're somewhat maybe more vulnerable than, you know, maybe some other areas in the state. Is there an effort to look at vulnerable spots?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Senator Moore. We have several areas, regions across the state, and they all have different hazards and different vulnerabilities and different effects on not only the state of Minnesota but on the country if things happen. We have our urban area of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Dakota County that have some specific guidelines and specific activities and that they have to perform that maybe those folks up in Kitson County and Kuching don't have to. So we are focusing activities that are unique to each of the regions, because there are some regions that are international borders, some that have ports on the Great Lakes. So all of those are within their region, very unique, and doing regional activities, as is the metropolitan area with all of our vulnerabilities here.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingridson.
Yes, Senator Moff, if I might just give you a little idea, too, coming from the rural area before being elected, I was, as you know, the sheriff, but I was also the county's emergency management director. Now, each county has to have an emergency management director. Why I, as sheriff, kept that particular position, sometimes I wondered, but especially when Y2K started and then, of course, after 9/11. But what's come of all this has been an awful lot of good, quite frankly, in dealing with the Homeland Security Emergency Management. People at the state of Minnesota has been a fantastic group to work with, and also the Department of Health. That's something that we never worked with before. And working with them, preparing for total nastiness, if you will, or potential nastiness, terroristic threats and whatever, after 9/11, some things, as they say, good comes from those things that are bad, and that was one of the good things. So this has been a great program.
Senator, just for future reference, it's helpful for the record if we're targeting an area for discussion to identify the section of the bill or the line and the page so we know where we're talking about. And just for the record, that reference there was on page 3, lines 3.22 to 3.24. Any other follow-up questions on that topic? Why don't we go back and resume where we left off?
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Turner?
I believe that we were at the Community Services Division of the Department of Corrections, which is the department's probation and supervised release division. We have heard the governor's bill. There are a number of new initiatives. I can just read them off if you want, but they have been discussed in the committee already. I'll try and make this brief. We have $1.6 million for intensive supervised release agents for the Challenge Incarceration Program at Moose Lake. $600,000 for intensive supervised release agents for the conditional release program that we created last year. $450,000 to fund the Interstate Inmate Compact. $700,000 to fund risk assessment and community notification for sex offenders. We have $5.6 million as a pass-through to the Community Corrections Act counties. $1.2 million for county probation officers. $1.2 million for state probation officers. So those are the three probation delivery systems. And they're all getting fairly substantial increases. $5.4 million for supervision of adult sex offenders. $600,000 for supervision of juvenile sex offenders. $1.5 million for sex offender treatment at the community level. It'd be non-prison. $1.5 million for sex offender evaluation, including polygraphs. $150,000 for sex offender assessment reimbursements to counties. $1.2 million to expand the sentence to serve program. $4.4 million for the short-term offender reimbursement to counties, which we had quite an extensive discussion of in this committee a couple weeks ago. $2.2 million for reentry services. And those are the new corrections initiatives. The only other agency funded by the bill is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and Section 15 appropriates $1.2 million to the Guidelines Commission. Then we have Article 2. We have a couple statutory changes. Section 1 provides that all gifts to the Department of Human Rights be deposited in a special account and appropriated to the Commissioner of Human Rights to help finance the operations of the department. Sections 2, 3, and 5 have to do with the 911 emergency telecommunication services. Section 2 authorizes an increase by 10 cents a month on and after July 1st in the years 2008, 2009, and 2010. And this is Section 1 of Senate File 1159, as I mentioned earlier. And I might as well go into 1159 now. What 1151, excuse me.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
It authorizes an increase in the service fee, like I said, by 10 cents a month. The current fee is 65 cents. This would raise it to 75 cents in 2008, 85 in 2009, 95 in 2010. The increased revenue is appropriated to acquire sites for and to design and construct the 800 megahertz public safety radio communication system in the remainder of the state, which would be southwestern Minnesota, western Minnesota, and northern Minnesota. And the fee will provide debt service for the $186 million that will be needed to fund the radio system for the remaining 55 counties that are not served. The projected finish date of the last phases of the system is January 2013.
Mr. Turner, is there funding in the bill to update the technological infrastructure for the metro area, which was the first part that was built out and is now a bit old? I've been told it's about time to refurbish that or update it.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm under the impression that the $186 million in bonding is just to provide money for phases 4, 5, and 6, but Mr. Whitehead here can tell you more.
Mr. Whitehead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, could you repeat the question? I couldn't hear it clearly.
Sure. The question is whether the bill provides funding to update the technological infrastructure for the metro area, which was the first phase, and which is now, I'm told, a number of years old and ready for some updating, as technology seems to be.
Senator Latz, members of the committee, the proposal does provide $5.4 million. That's money that we already have. It's not from bonding to upgrade the infrastructure in the metropolitan area. And that isn't necessarily the infrastructure would go on for another 15, 20 years under this platform. But because we've delayed the implementation of this, the implementation in phase three and other phases is on another version of the platform. So to maintain the maximum level of interoperability, the system should be maintained on one platform. And so it provides the $5.4 million to upgrade that the phase one and two of the implementation.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions on this area? Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, not in the 911 surcharge. So if somebody has another question, I'll be fine.
Any other follow-up? Okay, go ahead with your question, Senator.
I'm curious about the new language about the gifts and all gifts, bequests, grants, or other payments, public and private. Was this drafted to a specific situation? And can somebody just talk about that?
You're missing me. We're
I'm sorry. Page 16, line 8.
It's the Department of Human Rights.
Department of Human Rights. Is there someone here from the Department of Human Rights that can answer that question?
Mr. Chairman, Jim King from the Department of Finance again. This provision, we had some discussions with the Department of Human Rights over the years, and they didn't have explicit authority to spend any dedicated receipts. Most agencies have that authority, and they do get some receipts from time to time, and we wanted to make certain there was no question about their legal authority to do that. So that's why the language is included in the bill here.
Mr. King, when you say receipts, that's in terms of like attorney's fees or things that they've collected from the cases that they're working on?
Senator Moi, they do get some receipts. They get some gift receipts that are, as most agencies do, a small amount of gift receipts for particular projects, and that's what this is for. There's other receipts they do get from reimbursements from the federal government for EEOs, or from the EEOC, and those receipts do and will continue to go to the general fund. It's reimbursement for cost of cases. This is for particular gifts that the department receives.
Mr. King, I'm not expecting to know all the details, and it sounds like you might not have all the details. Can you just have the Department of Human Rights maybe send us a little note to tell us what specifically they're thinking of wanting to address in this area, or is it just receipts? I mean, it's not clear to me exactly what receipts is.
There is somebody here from the department. If you wish them to speak, we had asked though to have this language included because, like other agencies, they do get these, and they. It did not appear to have the statutory authority to do that. We wanted to make certain they did. Mr. Kirkpatrick's here from the department.
James Kirkpatrick, Department of Human Rights.
Mr. Kirkpatrick.
This covers situations where individuals and or foundations grant us monies to spend for specific projects, and this would clear up an issue that has happened at least two or three times since I've been here, where a private agency has given us or a grant, and we've had to go through to get the right to spend the money and the purpose that it was given to us.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, we have one section left. It's Section 4 of Article 2. And Section 4 is traveling as a separate bill, Senate File 851, authored by Senator Higgins. It's also in the governor's bill here. It's the result of a mandated legislative task force to make recommendations regarding the management of sex offenders. It expands the mandatory sex offender assessments after conviction and before sentencing by including the following crimes. And we've got a list there. I won't give the statutory sites. I'll just name them. Bestiality, solicitation, inducement, and promotion of prostitution. Other prostitution crimes, criminal sexual predatory conduct, dangerous sex offenders, solicitation of children, incest, abuse of minors in a sexual performance, and possession of child pornography. And that, Mr. Chairman, is the bill.
Members, there's a good explanation of the Senate File 851 provisions in Section 4 in the budget book on page 21.
That's why we can't find it.
That's why we get the budget books. Mr. Turner, maybe you can answer a question. It might be in the budget book, but I'll just ask you first. The provision under Section 609.322, the solicitation provisions, does that include misdemeanor-level solicitations?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to ask for Ken Backus's assistance on that one.
Mr. Backus? Or the 609.324 as well, other prostitution crimes.
Madam Mr. Chair, maybe if you can give me a moment so I can
jerk it up. You know, if there are any other questions, while Mr. Backus is looking up the answer, why don't we see if there are any other. Senator Rosen, do you have any questions?
I'd like to think of something, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other members of the audience here that would like to testify or provide some information to the committee in connection with the governor's proposals? And we will move, Mr. Backus, if you know the answer now, fine. If not, you can give it to me off the record.
Mr. Chair, no, there are misdemeanor offenses in 609.324, which is the other prostitution offenses. So there are misdemeanor offenses. And I was looking at the sex offender assessment, and it looks like Subdivision 1 requires a sex offender assessment upon conviction, so I think that would apply to the misdemeanors as well.
Delayed
over.
So, 322, that also is misdemeanor related?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe those are all felonies.
Okay. But it's upon conviction, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So that in the case of, I know at least in some jurisdictions, a solicitation charge on a misdemeanor, put it more layman's terms, a person soliciting a prostitution, a John, if you will. Some jurisdictions have diversion programs set up pre-conviction for first offense type situations that would not be included in this provision. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members, I think more the operative language would be the 609.3457, which is the sex offender assessment, of which this section only amends the definition. But no, I believe it says it has to be convicted of a sex offense. So if there's some kind of pretrial diversion that it doesn't result in a conviction, then I don't believe you'd get an assessment under that provision.
Okay. Any other questions while we're still on this bill? Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think the appropriate motion would be to lay the bill over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Would you like Mr. Chair, I would so move.
Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File number 650 is laid over for possible inclusion. Now we'll go on to Senate File 813. This is Senator Higgins' bill, who is exquisite in her timing, has returned to the witness table. And this is the Office of Justice Programs Eliminated Federal Funds Replacement Bill.
Mr. Chair, this is probably going to be very quick. If you would all open your budget books to the appendix, page 97. This is a summary of the federal funds that that the state gets. In it, we show the the fiscal year revenues for 2006 and 2007, and then the estimated for 2008 and 2009. And as we have talked several times in this committee, the federal grants of all kinds are slip-sliding away. They are, for example, the burn grants, where they once were $245,000, the estimated 2008 is zero. And we can see that all the way through this appendix. Here's another burn grants for anti-drug grants. In 2006, it was almost $12 million, and estimated for 2008 is $3 million. And so all this bill does is put a placeholder in here for if we can get the money in our division to replace some of these federal grants, because we know that the work that's being done out in the community using these grants is really important in doing good things for us all over the state. So I wanted to have a bill that just was here to replace these federal grants without losing some of the programs that we did. And that's it. I don't have anybody to testify. This was just, we don't know yet what our division will get for funds. We all heard the forecast today. It's not like we've got a whole lot of funds. We'll find out in the next probably week or 10 days what we have to spend, and then we'll know whether this has any legs at all. But at this point, I'll stand for any questions.
Are there any questions of the author? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins, this is truly amazing when you look at what the federal, mm-hmm. what the feds have done to us. I guess my question to you what are we doing with our federal delegation to make sure that we receive the funds to the state of Minnesota that we deserve? I feel sometimes there is a disparity issue even amongst the states. Mm-hmm. I was talking about a disparity issue between Greater Minnesota and the Metro, but it is certainly out there with us versus the other states. And I'm just hoping that perhaps we can develop a better relationship with our federal delegation to make sure that they do the appropriate moves to acquire these federal funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I sent a letter to our entire delegation asking them if they would please, start getting these funds back to numbers that we used to have, and in particular the burn grants. As you know, the budget didn't get done in a timely manner in Congress before the election last year, and so they're now passing this year's budget, even though the president has already sent them next year's budget. By the way, the president zeroed out the burn grants in the next year's budget that he sent up the hill. But I think, I think we all should be talking to our federal delegation to make them understand how important these grants are all over the state for things that I think most of our delegation would believe would be very important. I had a chance to speak with the federal lobbyist for some of our cities and some of the various organizations, and put a bug in his ear a couple of weeks ago about if he wouldn't mind talking to the delegation about how much we need these federal grants. So that's what I've been doing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. And Senator Higgins, I wonder if perhaps we should develop a priority list of these funds that we could present to, because this is a little daunting when you start looking at all.
Yeah, isn't it?
and perhaps get a group of people together to say, this is where we would like to have you place some attention and mm-hmm. follow and track. Many of these programs, I think, are being tracked, perhaps on our level or areas that we really don't have time to do this. And maybe we need to have a little bit more focus on some specific areas.
I think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, that's that bill. And if there are no other questions, I'd move the Senate file. Okay, the one I have doesn't have a number on it.
813
be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 813 is laid over. And there being no other business to come before the committee tonight, we are adjourned.
Thank you. It was easy.